Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Since the start of the U.S. COVID-19 outbreak, we have learned a lot about how to protect ourselves. We now know that since there's no vaccine yet, human behavior is the best weapon we have against the spread of the virus. Unfortunately, human behavior isn't something that we have exact control over. At first, most people were willing to do what made sense to save lives. Now, not so much. They are experiencing what's being called caution fatigue. What's that, and how, in the name of public health, can we convince people to take COVID-19 seriously again? Are you suffering from caution fatigue? Did you hit the saloons and salons this weekend? Or are you still avoiding outside contact as much as possible? And when you go on necessary errands, are you wearing that mask? What are the risk factors to going out and how do we mitigate them? What does it matter to you that public figures like President Trump and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick ignore safety measures and mock those who do? You can call in. We want to hear from you. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at @TPRSource. We're joined this hour by Dr. Daniel Musher. He's infectious disease specialist at the Baylor College of Medicine. And Dr. Musher, great to have you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Jose Cedeno Laurent, a research associate in the Etymology and Risk Program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And Jose Laurent, good to have you.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
And joining us also is Jacqueline Golan, a licensed clinical psychologist and associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Jacqueline Golan, good to have you with us.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So, Jacqueline, you're being credited with coining the phrase or popularizing the phrase caution fatigue. What do you mean by that?
Caution fatigue occurs when people show low motivation or energy to comply with safety guidelines. For example, we may become impatient with the warnings, or we don't believe them to be real or relevant, or we de-emphasize the actual risk. And as a result, we then end up bending some of those rules and stopping safety behaviors like washing our hands or social distancing.
You know, people undergo caution fatigue all the time. You know, if you live in Los Angeles or in Mexico City, you know you're living in an area where you could be hit by an earthquake at any time. Mm-hmm. Yet you somehow able to coexist with that.
That's true. We ignore alarms all the time. For nurses, they ignore alarms on medical equipment. Students can ignore school fire alarms. Essentially, what's happening is it's a noisy environment, and we're exposed to excessive or continual warnings, which are distracting, and then they generate stress for us. So to reduce the stress, we ignore those warnings around us.
So what I want to avoid is pandemic shaming in this conversation, and accept the fact that this quarantine fatigue or caution fatigue is a natural thing, but in the name of better public health, we should help people understand it and try to come to grips with it and have a more wide-eyed, realistic view of what risk they are undertaking. Does that sound right?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think there are different ways that people estimate the risk and rewards. And so they balance safety with risk in different ways. And maybe we could talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to Jose Cedeno Laurent at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And you take a look at risk in regards to epidemiology. And what are you observing?
So what we are observing is that at the beginning, we knew very little how the virus behaved. And I think that's why everyone adopted this very overly cautious set of measures to avoid transmission. But I think what we're hopefully looking at is that science understands a lot more about the main modes of transmission. And by doing so, we can engage into the proper administrative and engineering controls to mitigate some of these risks so that we can really choose on an evidence-based approach what are the risks that we could tolerate.
And Dr. Daniel Musher at the Baylor College of Medicine, as you're an infectious disease specialist, it seems like we have learned a lot about COVID-19 since it first, the outbreak began. And so there's been what we thought we learned. There's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding out into the public. And so what do you think we need to clear up?
I'm glad that you asked, and I'm glad to be here. Regarding the comment about fatigue, it's unfortunate that there has been some degree of, quote, fatigue among the public. When I first learned of this infection, I believe it was in the second week in January, there was an article in the paper saying there were 23,000 cases of a certain kind of coronavirus pneumonia in Wuhan. I said to my wife, to my family, to my students, I said, that's a pandemic, because some viruses do spread and some viruses don't spread. And that one clearly showed the ability to spread. And in a world where there's travel by plane all over the world, there's going to be a pandemic, and there has been one. With regard to people having fatigue about we can't control earthquakes, but we can, to some degree, control the spread of this infection. And if we have leaders of our country who have made a political statement by not wearing masks, this is a terrible thing. It's stupid. And it's bad leadership, and this shouldn't be politicized. This is very plain and straightforward. We talked a moment ago about evidence-based. There's a scientist at the NIH, Christina Bax, Bax is her last name, and she showed the spread of these particles. Everybody knows it, and we should be wearing masks, and we should continue to do so, especially as we are starting to break away from the isolation and the self-quarantining. So we have a long way to go to try to restrain the continued spread of this virus.
The mask situation, Dr. Musher, can you just talk about that for about a minute? How important is that?
Masks don't protect the non-infected person very well. They do sort of, and it depends upon how well they're worn. If a mask is worn by somebody who is infected, or who may be infected, or who may be a silent carrier because he or she hasn't had an active infection, a mask worn by that person really protects everybody else, because as we speak, we spread whatever is in our nasopharyngeal or in our oral secretions. And therefore, I don't know if I'm infected or not, but if I wear a mask, I'm protecting everybody else. I'm being considerate of everyone else.
So when we get more people to wear masks, we're doing a better job of containment, mitigation of the virus, and fewer people will catch it. But if we have caution fatigue, people are saying the mask is hot, it's uncomfortable, I don't like it, my constitutional rights, how are we going to convince people to do what saves lives? The number to call in is 833-877-8255. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the transmission of COVID-19, how to avoid that, what risks are out there, and also caution fatigue. How can we help other people understand what the risks are when they decide, I really want to go out. So I've been cooped up in this apartment for so long. If I don't get out of here, I'm going to go crazy. And, but the virus doesn't care. The virus does not care. It just wants to travel through the population. And so how are we going to help people deal with that? Let's go to the phone lines. Number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And this is Kathleen. And Kathleen, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I think that at the beginning of this pandemic, the United States was all pulling together. We were all one people. And now because of legislators in the federal government and in the state government making this a partisan issue is just insane. We are all humans. We should, any adult, responsible adult, should be wearing the mask to prevent the transmission of this disease. This disease is insidious. You could have it, not know it. You could be a carrier and never have symptoms, and therefore a mask prevents the spread of it. Wear your mask when you go out. I don't wear my mask in my car. I don't wear my mask in my front yard emptying the garbage because that's ridiculous. But I wear it when I'm going to go to the grocery store or to the pharmacy or anywhere else because I'm trying to be responsible for other people as well as myself. They've proven in Asian countries like Hong Kong, with that huge amount of people living in a closed environment, that they all wear masks as a matter of course nowadays. They don't go out if they're healthy or sick without wearing a mask. And look how little that disease has hit Hong Kong compared to New York City, where we didn't wear masks.
Okay, Jacqueline Golan, you're a licensed clinical psychologist, associate professor of psychiatry, behavioral sciences, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. You've coined this phrase, caution fatigue, and you've written about how people are dealing with this right now. But this specter of politicization of this, was that something that was anticipated?
I think any current issue is going to be absorbed and integrated into the perspective of politics. That's the zeitgeist of the U.S. now. I think what we need to understand here, I like the prior caller's points about really balancing safety with risk. I think what's happening here is that people have to make wise decisions in a world that has rearranged risk and reward here, reward being safety. And some people, depending on affiliation, culture, background, family concerns, medical history, are going to have different levels of risk that they're comfortable with. So they've got to ask themselves, what am I getting in return from a normal routine relative to what I'm giving up? So you could have a totally closed home environment with lower risk of illness. You have no contact with anybody. You don't go out except for emergencies. And you do something what I would call PDA, like you use public distancing, disinfecting, using deliveries and working and playing at home. You could do that, or you could do something very different, like a completely home environment, open home environment, where you have a significant chance of an illness and anything goes as before. The question here is something in between. Can we have modest isolation with low modest risk of illness, where you could see a doctor, a dentist, you could go out and do outside sports and go out with friends if you're careful with your PDA, and then resume parts of your normal routine, but give up some of your usual freedoms in order to get them back as a collective. So I think political affiliation can influence your viewpoint. Nothing is wrong here or incorrect. It's just simply now down to medical science. How do we care for each other? How do we take care of ourselves?
Jose Cedeno Laurent, a research associate of epidemiology and risk program at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The risk formula that people are looking at is one thing is what I have to go through to modify my behavior. Also, what my expectations are if I get this virus. And there is an argument out there. It's very strong. It's gone viral, saying that getting the coronavirus is not that bad. It only kills very few people, people who are old and weak and already compromised, but it's not going to impact me. So that seems to be a risk formula that people are kind of doing that calculus. And can you talk about that?
Yeah, so first of all, I think we first read the evidence from the infection in other countries or now in the U.S., and we know what are some of the personal risk factors that determine whether the infection really gets bad for a person or not. And in a certain sense, that is true. The issue is that we don't know. We don't know, in many cases, what are those risk factors. Even, I think the diagnosis of diabetes or other precondition is unknown. There is a reason why hypertension is called the silent killer, because many of us, we don't know that we have it. So as such, we might be among those high-risk groups of developing a severe case of COVID without knowing it. So that's regarding, I think, the personal risks. But I would say that every single person lives in a society, right? So we have to think of about the collective risk. You might not be that impacted by the infection, but how about your parents? How about others that live in your close social network? You might be putting them in unnecessary risk by taking these activities or engaging into these high-risk settings. So I think the equation is not as simple as it sounds, and it needs to incorporate the latest of science and of news that we are getting around the world. And I think that's something that has helped a lot in this case, because since the infection has had different waves in different parts of time and space, in this case countries, we are learning from these natural experiments on what to do and what not to do. Like the caller said, cases like Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, that have seen a much better approach to the infection.
Dr. Daniel Muscher, at the infectious disease specialist at Baylor College of Medicine. I really can't get a good figure, and it seems to be changing. I don't know if my information is dated or what, about what is the fatality rate for being infected with COVID-19? And also, I would like to know, what is the rate of people or for people who get it, they beat it, but yet they will have a lifetime of compromised health because of that?
Those are good questions. The last question, what's the long-term consequences? Of course, nobody knows, because we're not in the long term. The data on people who are sick enough to have a diagnosis of a disease, that's not a positive PCR test. They're sick enough to go into a hospital and have a disease. That mortality is about 3 to 5%, which is substantial. The reason the numbers keep shifting, David, is that, and I can't tell either, are they counting actual cases of disease as the denominator, or are they counting everybody who's got a positive test, which shows that that person may be carrying the virus or may have a very low-grade infection but went and got tested anyway? And that's what's very hard to say. The data on people getting hospitalized, it's about three on recognized cases of the disease, it's 3 or 4% mortality. Hospitalized in an ICU, it's something like 25 to 50% mortality. It's a bad disease.
So looking at those numbers, looking at the U.S. population, if we follow what some people would like to see, say, let it roll, let's go, let's let this thing happen, and we'll get it over with, that would mean millions of people would die from COVID-19. Dr. Muscher, is that about right?
I think so. Certainly hundreds of thousands, because we've already had 100,000. At the same time, I mean, I think that life in many ways is going to have to go on. I think schools do need to reopen. It's been done in other countries. And it's got to be redundant. You can't keep our kids out of school forever.
Sure, business has got to reopen. But let's do it in a way where we can mitigate the risk. And we have to do that. We have to identify the risk and help people deal with that in a way. This is sort of shaming of people who don't want to go out in the public. That's something else that's happening. And how do we, you know, defang that? Let me go to Greg on the phones. Greg, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. A couple of things. One, I think we all ought to be careful about letting our political beliefs influence our healthcare decisions. And the other is when we're out exercising, you know, I understand about the distance and all that, but it's important to wear a mask when we're out exercising, because our vapor trail is so much bigger when you're out huffing and puffing, and folks would be be well served to wear a mask. And I mean, I know it stinks wearing a mask out there when you're working out, but it helps to keep from spreading it. Because if you're down, even if you're 6, 8, 10 feet away from someone, if you're downwind of that person and they're huffing and puffing, you just got exposed. So, you know, there's a difference between being Texas tough and being dumb. You know, we all need to start just acting a little bit more mature about this.
Okay, Greg, thank you for that. So when this outbreak first happened and we were rushing around looking for masks, I couldn't find one anywhere. So I was using a mask that I had bought for running that was there to help me build up my lung capacity and help filter out pollen while I ran. And so, I mean, this thing about running and with a mask is not good for you. I mean, it's something that runners do all the time to get better at running. But let me go to Dr. Muscher about the idea of airborne and how we've changed a lot of our thinking about the airborne quality of COVID-19.
That last caller was absolutely right, made a really good point. In just ordinary conversation, there is a spread of virus droplets, and they spread a certain number of feet. And there's some question about whether there are a number of feet, and there's a certain number of viruses it needs to infect somebody. But the more huffing and puffing somebody does, the more that's going to be. If you yell at somebody, that's going to greatly increase the number of viral particles.
And sing.
Singing, I was about to get there because I'm a musician of sorts. The Texas Medical Center Orchestra can't rehearse because the strings could probably do it by socially distancing, but the woodwinds and the brass couldn't possibly play. We were going to do Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with a chorus. No chorus can possibly rehearse under these conditions. So this is going to be put off for a number of months till we see what happens.
Airflow is a big part of this situation, and Jose Cedeno Lawrence, can you talk about that? Like in a room, air circulating.
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, COVID-19 is predominantly an indoor virus. So the biggest spreading events have happened indoors. And something we know is that the virus seems to be behaving like other coronaviruses in terms of the aerodynamic properties of it. So we know that to remove a virus from the air, there are two main mechanisms. One is removal from ventilation, so replacing the air inside by fresh outdoor air, or by filtration. There are other modes of inactivating the virus, like UV light that is used in some nosocomial settings. But definitely there's enough set of engineering controls that with time could be incorporated into our building to mitigate the risks of infection.
Initially, it was thought that the coronavirus was not actually an quote-unquote airborne virus, but it did sort of exist in the aerosol, the outward breath. But now we know that it could live up to about maybe like to 10, 15 minutes in a room in the air. Real quickly, Jose, is that correct?
So, yeah, the half-life of the virus in the air depends precisely on those two factors that I just mentioned. The ventilation rate of a space. So a poor ventilated space will definitely have a longer residence time of stagnant aerosols. These viral particles that Dr. Muscher was talking about. At the beginning, no one, or at least the authority, didn't recognize that this was a risk. But the more we know about it, the more that we think it's a very important mode of transmission.
Right. So we're learning more all the time. That means always check the date when that article you're reading about coronavirus, when did that come out? If it's more than 2 weeks old, I would give it a jaundice eye. Okay, we're taking a break here. The number is 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the virus transmission of COVID-19 and also caution fatigue, how people are kind of, they get tired of being cooped up and then they're taking unnecessary risks that could expose them to the virus and it could cost them their lives. So you can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. Jacqueline Golan, you coined the phrase caution fatigue. You said there are some mind traps that people kind of get caught into. What are those?
Yeah, mind traps are sort of mental models that are formed based on learning, and we're reluctant to change them. And so we end up paying more attention to information that fits with that mental model, that preconceived idea. And we pay less attention to information that contradicts them. So we twist information essentially to make it fit what we think things should be. So if you're using the words should, must, need, in the way that you think, it should be this way, it has to be this way, you know, you sort of set a kind of rigid mental model about something. So if somebody says, I don't think I have to wear a mask in a store, or I shouldn't have to, we know that that's rigid thinking and that is a strong mental trap.
And you see these images, photographs, video, people going to the beach, going to the bars, going to the beauty salon in mass, and they're doing it. And we have our political leaders saying, it's okay, go ahead and go. People can come up with some mental framework that says, well, it must be all right, or else this wouldn't be happening.
Mm-hmm. I think if people can practice some perspective taking and be a little more altruistic in their thinking, a little more we thinking, not me thinking, that may also modify some of those traps that people or those expectations that people have for themselves.
We have these very vocal protest people out and about saying, you know, it's my constitutional right. I shouldn't have to wear a mask. You can't do that to me. And say, well, the Constitution gave you the right to bear arms. It didn't give you the right to bear your face. And unless you think that your face is a lethal weapon, then that's, you shouldn't have to do that. But so how do we reach people like this? So Jose Cedeno Larnt, how do we talk to people as you study, you know, your risk at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health? Do you talk about the social science of it?
Yeah, so I think for researchers, it's always a big challenge to communicate our scientific findings properly and effectively. So at least for the topic of COVID, our team at the School of Public Health in Harvard, we created this webpage where we have a series of documents of even like SOPs, standard operation procedures on how to deal with some like mundane things like the receiving a package in the mail or going out getting groceries, or how do we handle a COVID case at home. So these have been like distilled from the science, decades of science on infectious transmission, infectious disease transmission, and put out in like these very easy to digest infographics. I would say to your point, additionally, of how do we feel about looking at these people going out to the beach without wearing a mask? And I think what we need here is a change in the, how we conceive these activities. We normally hear that we have the right to be there. And I think we better think of it as we have a privilege to be there. And if by doing these massive events where not everyone is being careful, transmission of the disease can go back to the previous levels we had in March, and then that privilege can be taken out from us. So I think if we do it safely, we can preserve that privilege and do it extended to the community.
Dr. Daniel Muscher, infectious disease specialist at Baylor College of Medicine. So I imagine there is a different level of risk for different specific situations. And it's going to the grocery store in a way that where you have your mask on and you're very careful and you put all the hand sanitizer on and you get what you need and you go home. Or there's a way to navigate that with minimal risk, but going out to the bars or going out to get your hair cut, that's a different level of risk?
David, that's exactly right. And I'm not sure how to deal with the question of going to a bar or going to get your hair cut. If you're going to get your hair cut, you and your hairdresser have to understand that there's a mutual bond and there's got to be good masks worn properly by both. Dr. Golan mentioned altruism. Basically, you have to be concerned about other people. And Dr. Cedeno Lawrence mentioned, you know, Harvard's got a website and so on. The problem, David, is that the leaders, some leaders of our country, who should be setting an example for the whole country, are out there purposely objecting. They've politicized this, and they are not wearing masks, and they are not doing the things that are good for our society. And I don't know how you can counteract that. I honest to God don't.
Well, we do have some political leaders who are masking up and doing things. I mean, I guess that's one way to do it.
Well, that's what my wife and I have been doing. We go when we go out in the public, just exactly as your callers in, we're very good. At home, we don't wear masks, but when we go out, we do. And we're doing it out of consideration to everybody else as much or even more than to be protective of ourselves. Because, as I say, I know that the mask is more protective of everybody else than it is of me.
So, Dr. Musher, what places and situations do you think are the most high risk for potential transmission? And we talked about hairdressers, and we had a couple of cases here recently where hairdressers continued to work. They didn't go shut down when they were supposed to, and they have infected dozens and dozens and dozens of people.
Okay, so we discussed specific situations. Let's begin with a hot topic item, which is churches. So I'm Jewish. I go to services every Saturday morning of my life. I haven't been to services for the last 2.5 months. They canceled them. They're available. I can catch streaming services, which is absolutely not the same in the Jewish religion. There's supposed to be 10 people present to have a service. And I'm part of a smaller service, and we have a Zoom service. Other churches have opened and have had real distancing, so they've blocked off 2 out of every 3 seats, and they've blocked off alternate rows. And that does a lot of social distancing, but you sing a hymn loud if you're not and the people should be masked. Sing a hymn good and loud, and that's going to spread viruses all over the place. Theaters, movie theaters, I don't think they should open. That's a closed space. Unless they've got fabulous ventilation, and they have good ventilation, but I wouldn't personally. I'm not a worried kind of a person, but I would not go to a movie. And symphonies, the Houston Symphony has canceled the season for next year. The Medical Center Orchestra has canceled its opening concerts in indoor theater. Although we may give a concert in November in Miller Outdoor Theater because that's outdoors. So I think everybody knows. I think they're just, their knowledge needs to be reinforced by our leaders, and they need to be exposed to the right information. And I think certain news channels do their very best to politicize the issue and disseminate misinformation.
All right, let me go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255, and this is Wing. Wing, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say we need to, like, take into other countries that have best practices, right? Like Germany, Taiwan, Hong Kong. They've been wearing masks all over, 100%. And then only if they are, like the other listeners say, well, if you're outdoor and if you're not with people, then you don't have to wear a mask. But then if you're with around a lot of people, then you need to wear a mask to protect yourself and for the other people. So I think we lack of, like, looking on into other best practices country and use the example to prove that this works and then convince people that, hey, yeah, this is your right, but other people have the right to pursue happiness and be alive too. So that's conclude what I have to say.
All right, Wing, thank you for that call. Jacqueline Golan, as you look at the behavioral sciences you're with Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Are you looking at how different countries are managing this and how some are successful and some aren't?
not in a formal research way, but certainly with interest. I think mask wearing was more the norm prior to the pandemic. I think there were numerous pandemics that some countries faced in years past, and mask wearing became the norm. You would see it in Japan and Taiwan, certainly Hong Kong. So if someone had a cold, they would wear a mask as a way of both not transmitting it, but also to protect the people around them. So I think this is a very new behavior for the U.S. I think it's opened up a robust discussion about ways in which we can care for each other and ourselves, how much we need to revert to updated scientific information used by medical professionals so that we can stay safe. So the short answer is yes, other countries are doing it better in with more attention and greater adherence by the citizenry. And that is, I think, due to, you know, strong leadership, clear standardized messaging, and in general, an attention among the citizenry to take care of each other.
Japan doing a very good job. They did not go into a formal lockdown. They just told people to wear masks, and they had a pretty widespread, almost complete, entire compliance with that. And they've been managed to keep their economy rolling along. And people, they have very low, and they're able to contain and mitigate the virus when it does become evident. They're not even doing the widespread testing because they're doing such a good job there. A lot we can learn from how they have handled COVID-19. The number is 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the transmission of COVID-19. What are the risks? How to avoid them? And how do you deal with caution fatigue in yourself and those around you? How can we fight against that so that we can get people to deal with this in a responsible manner? And hopefully we can get through this sooner rather than later, get the economy back open, get people back to work. So let's go to Erwin on the phones, 833-TPR-TALK. And Erwin, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. My question is, does this spread through ducts of air conditioning? Let's say I'm social isolating in an office, nobody's around, but could the person down the hall or upstairs give it to me through recirculating air conditioning air? And a secondary question is, could this spread without droplets?
Okay, thank you for that call, Erwin. Let me go to Jose Cedeno Laurent, Research Associate of Epidemiology Risk Program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Jose?
Yeah, so these are excellent questions. And so as far as we know, there's a minimal risk of this happening, but there's really more evidence that we need to determine whether this could be a long-range airborne transmission. What we know is that if the transmission happens mostly to short-range, large droplets, so these are the tiny droplets that we emit when we breathe, when we speak, when we sneeze or cough, but also those droplets basically dry out and leave only the virion, the particle that carries the virus, most likely a viable virus, and that could travel further down. So in most ventilation settings, you would expect these particles to settle and then to become, to basically inactivate. What we are recommending, though, is the use of filtration systems that basically comply with the certification MERV 13 or higher. So these are very well known to filter a very high percentage, not more than 90% of those particles in the aerodynamic range of the viral particles that we're talking about. So definitely, even if it's recirculated air, if it's filtered, the risk of these viruses to be in the air is much lower or practically negligible.
Dr. Daniel Musher from the Baylor College of Medicine. I hear about the R-naught number for these infectious diseases. That's like the exponential rate in which this spreads. When we talk about COVID-19, is the rate of its spread based upon normal conditions or with social distancing? How are we measuring that?
Very important question. The rate of spread initially was, of course, without any kind of social distancing. I do believe that the statistics show that with the social distancing in the United States and other countries, with mask wearing and social distancing, that really does decrease the rate of spread. And, of course, the concern that everyone has is what's going to happen when we come out of our self-quarantining, what happens when we come out of our isolation. And I think we're going to go back to transmitting the virus if we don't follow these precautions. You asked me earlier which specific conditions are a problem. There have been photographs of people at a crowded bar not wearing masks. I think that's nuts. I think there's a perfect situation. People, you got to talk loud at a bar because there's a lot of noise. They're talking loud. One person infected or carrying the virus can spread that virus down the entire bar. Everybody in that place can become infected. And those are the issues we have to deal with, and we have to accept social responsibility. Some of the Scandinavian countries have done better because there's a much higher sense of social responsibility. The same as mentioned before with Hong Kong. I mean, people are trained, they're bred to look after each other. This isn't a question of personal liberty. This is a question of being part of a social contract.
So bars, people tend to drink alcohol in bars. In fact, some people say that's the only reason why you actually go there and to socialize. Jacqueline Golan, you've looked at how alcohol dampens the ability to measure risk, and that's not a good thing to be doing, drinking alcohol and figuring out what is the risk you're undertaking in connection to COVID-19, correct?
Yes, you're right. The research shows that there's increased risk-taking when under the influence of alcohol or alcohol-related cues. So it would stand your logic to see that if someone was going to go to the bar this weekend with friends and they drank a lot, that they may be less likely to wear the mask while drinking, but also after they've drunk a bit. So, yeah, there is a lot of work that's shown that.
Jose Cedeno Laurent. Okay, I Googled you and I saw some other research about, and tell me if this is correct or not, that you said that people get dumber in a heat wave when they're exposed to heat, that they're not able to assess risk as capable. Is that true?
Well, yeah, we have found several environmental factors that inhibit our ability to think clearly. Curiously, one of the things that we find is heat is affecting our cognitive abilities, but also ventilation, and in particular carbon dioxide. So we have done a series of studies documenting how these different environmental parameters affect our ability to take high-order decision functions.
Let's go to the phone lines with Karen. Karen, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Okay, I'm a massage therapist. They opened us up for massage in the state of Texas, which I'm a little bit leery. Some of the things that I have read on the massage blog or some information that I've gotten is to use a UV light that produces ozone. Now, what I've read is that is not really a very good idea. And are there any other ways that I can protect myself since I am like 5 inches above somebody's mouth?
All right, Karen, thank you for that. Dr. Daniel Musher, any thoughts?
I'd rather refer the question to Dr. Cedeno Laurent, but basically a massage therapist needs to wear a mask and needs to have her client wear a mask and make sure that mask is close-fitting. Dr. Cedeno Laurent, what do you think?
I agree. The use of masks is necessary, but Dr. Musher
mentioned something critical about masks early in this program, and it was the fit of the mask. So we know that now, and since March, we have had a problem with the supply of N95 masks. The reality is that these masks work very well if they are worn properly. So ideally, what we would find is that this personal protection equipment is available for all these high-risk settings, and people are trained and are given the fitting of the mask so that they avoid the risks. On top of that, I would say that UV light as such in this application does not necessarily work very well. There are other settings, especially in hospitals, where it has proven to work well, but that's cleaning the air at very high rates, not to clean or disinfect surfaces. Additionally, a very important point was brought up, that is how you may introduce these unwanted contaminants or secondary pollutants by doing some of these measures, right? So ozone is an irritant. So first, if the method is not working and it generates a secondary pollutant, then we're at a range of other, at risk of other respiratory symptoms.
Okay. I'm going to get this last caller on the air. John, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Thank you, David. I'd like to talk about maybe a better media response to leadership messaging that sends out heavy messages that only old people and minorities are susceptible to the illness. And that might account for some of the masks not being worn. It's how to contradict that and make it that we're really all in here. We're not doing favors for old people and heightening intergenerational conflict that already exists, as well as racial conflict.
All right, John, thank you for that call. We're short on time here, so let me see if I can get some response from Dr. Daniel Musher about the messaging here.
The caller is correct. It does sound as if it's just old people and certain minority groups, but it is everybody, and as has been pointed out by Dr. Golan, this is a question of decency and of consideration for everybody else. We need to observe these precautions. We need leaders, political leaders, people who show up in the press. They need to be wearing masks to teach the populace to do it.
And so, Dr. Jacqueline Golan, if you could talk a little bit about, let's move forward. How can we get people to do proper behavior, save lives?
Update yourself with credible safety information that's vetted by medical professionals, like pay attention and differentiate what's true message from false message. See if you can change up your media consumption to credible resources so you're getting real news and not the drama. And also, presumably because it's fresh and new, you'll catch your attention. I think stay focused on being respectful to others, pursuing altruism, social responsibility. Modify those mind traps. Try to say, I prefer I have the opportunity to go to the beach. I prefer to go to the beach, but I don't have the right to go to the beach, as a way of modifying things. And see if you can stay focused on routines to reduce your decision-making fatigue and so forth.
All right, Jacqueline Golan is with the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, also joined by Jose Cedeno Laurent with the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and Dr. Daniel Musher, infectious disease specialist at Baylor College of Medicine. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.